We are Two Guys Gaming. As always, even though the intro says Two Guys Gaming, this is One Guy Reading. Whether you meant to or not, you found Newest Book Club. I'm Sean, noob of all trades from Two Generations Gaming, and in this particular episode, I am finally finishing The Dragon Republic, the novel by R.F. Kuang. I took a break during October to finish up Frankenstein, and then I got busy last week, and my son and I went to Rhode Island for the Comic-Con this weekend. After this, I'm going to do a book called Legends and Lattes. My November theme for this year is laid back and cozy and comfortable and thankful for gaming. So I thought that might be a nice little addition to Noob's Book Club. Next month I have Dune on the schedule. The way that this one runs, on Frankenstein I didn't give you any summaries. Not even really that. I just kind of gave my thoughts on the section as a whole. This one I'm going to go back to. I will give you the summary of the chapter. And then I will tell you my thoughts on the chapter, and at the end I'll wrap it up and post it. Okay, enough introduction. Let's get into it. This is The Dragon Republic, Part 6, Chapters 31 through 37. Chapter 31 Summary. Rin Kete and Venka wait together on a cliff for Daishi's fleet to arrive. Nisha is stationed on the fleet's front lines. Their attacks, replicating Jinja's siege tactics, and immediately decimating the Republican fleet. Rin saves Nisha, who has just defeated Jun, the old master at Sinigar. However, Jun jumps off the ship before they can kill him. Together, Rin and Nisha defeat Chang En just as Phelan enters the battle. And now for my thoughts on Chapter 31. As mentioned, the Empire uses Jin Jia's own tactics against him. This begs the question, well, begs several questions. The one I want to address involves the nature of war and the cycle of violence. We always hear about the latest advancements in weaponry. Buffett said that any time we invent something new, the first application that we consider is how to use it to blow each other up. It used to be a joke. Now, though, that I see and understand how things work, if it's a joke, it's a terribly unfunny one. War completely wags the dog. But let's pose the question anyway. In this society, we are told that great men, working all alone, create the new and exciting widget that then gets co-opted and thrown into the war machine. But there's the disconnect for me now. What if, and stay with me now, war is the reason. Suppose if you can that the only reason that society advances right now is because of war. At least in America, I read once that we spent less than 1% of our existence not actively at war. That sounds insane and unsustainable to you. I ask you to consider. Parenthetically, you can't see me, but I'm gesturing broadly at everything. We founded our country on war, built it on slavery and genocide, and repeatedly paved over that with talk of freedom. We quote-unquote fought and defeated the Nazis, as we're so fond of reminding everyone. As their ultimate fate, we actually allowed them to flee to South America. Some we welcomed into our space program as engineers to beat the damn commies in the Soviet Union. Meanwhile, we were allowed the anger and hatred to fester from the Civil War. Apparently we thought the quote-unquote invisible hand might lead them away from evil. Oops, should have read your Bible better. Root of all evil and all that. Add in the supercharger of the internet and social media, and you get MAGA. I know this. Might feel off topic, and will probably get me sent to El Salvador. A, I don't think enough people listen to get me deported, and B, it is very much on topic. No coincidence that everything in our society becomes a quote-unquote war. Drugs, poverty, terrorism. Now active and open calls for a civil war. The military invented the internet with Al Gore, and the psychos who want to be dictators weaponized it. So yeah, war is our only motivation. And that's why it's all rotting. If we get the chance, we can build something. Something real. If only. I usually talk about two things in each chapter, but that one took quite a bit of time. We have dealt with Rin, Nisha, Jun, and the symbolism of their battle as it relates to the past. Having discussed this at some length, I refer you to the previous episodes. We'll connect it to the topic just discussed, and parenthetically again, say The two things can be true. It can both represent a significant victory, parenthetically, but potentially hollow and parenthetical, and the tragic erosion of innocence in the past. Complete lack of imagination, creation through destruction. Yeah, that all tracks. Chapter 32 summary. Rin uses her wings to rise to Phelan's level. She distracts him and lures him to a cliff where Kate and Ramsay planted explosives. She uses a fire in the cliff, burying Phelan, which is shot into the water by javelins. Underwater, Neesha finds her and surfaces them far downstream. Rin's wings have pierced her back, and Neesha is overcome by the dragon. He brought opium, and Rin lights it and forces him to inhale. He wants to leave to rejoin the battle. Neesha realizes they quote-unquote already won, and he sees Hesperian ships on the horizon. My thoughts on Chapter 32. Okay, let's talk metaphor. Remember I said that fire and water both have the power to destroy one another and to enhance one another? Let me take a bit of a victory lap here. Rin and Neesha work together to defeat their common enemy and showcase that ability of fire and water to work together. Neesha saves him from drowning, only to brutally torture and kill him on the shore as Rin watches. War. War never changes. But it changes us in irreparable ways. God damn. But wait, there's more. Phelan heads into the battle. Rin uses her new wings, some psychology, and good old-fashioned explosives to defeat him. I promise the battle is much more exciting in the book. Read it if you had. The victory is short-lived, and Neesha has to save her. But the quote-unquote ultimate victory looks almost assured at this point. At what price, as they say, remains to be seen. Chapter 33 summary. Daji appears. She believes there, quote, are no victors, end quote, after their war. Rin taps into new reservoirs of power and pins Daji, using pressure to destroy her eyeballs. Daji shows her vision of Nakan burning under Mugen occupation. She explains why they betrayed the Caitriads and gave provinces to the Muganese. Daji apologizes for hurting her and Altan, and she says Rin doesn't recognize the quote-unquote true enemy. Shows Rin a vision of her past, where she was raped by a Hesperian and saved by a Muganese soldier. Says the Muganese were quote-unquote puppets to disguise the crimes of Hesperia. She leaves, but says Rin will need her help in the future. Later, Kate and Vaeka find Rin and Neesha. My thoughts on Chapter 33. Okay, Kwong wants us to reconsider, well, pretty much everything at this point. I usually chalk that up to lazy writing. Not that it isn't here, but remember, she was a kid when we wrote these books. So I give her a pass on the quote, what you thought was true really wasn't, end quote. Besides, I fully admit to being ignorant of the politics behind the story. Maybe those who knew better saw this all coming. Regardless, Daji drops a tooth bomb on Rin. She, like Neesha, shows her a vision that should give her pause. Unlike Neesha's, that she blew off, Daji's vision gives her a look into the Empire's past. Some real deep stuff, actually. Context with the Sorkin Sira, Caitriads, and the founding of the country give Daji more humanity. She claims more than once that she and Rin are very much alike. Seems that Kwong makes the point that they are one and the same. At least that's how I interpreted it. Both suffered trauma when young. Both use that trauma to fuel monstrous acts. Strangely, even though it should make me like Daji more, it also gives me more of a perspective on thinking about Rin. It means Daji's revelation makes her actions look even more horrific, if possible. Nuking an entire island is pretty fucked up to begin with. But nuking an entire island of innocent people due to their actions at the hands of a ruthless leader, well, that's really fucked up. And I rightly judged her for it. Several times I said that I might not be able to finish the book because I found her completely loathsome. Now, though, she falls victim to those very same machinations. She allowed herself to be manipulated by the Hesperians into making the Muganese the enemy. To her credit, she saved room for the opposite to be true, especially as evidence mounted in that direction. Chapter 34 summary. When Rin wakes, Vaeka fills her in on how the battle went. Kate says Neesha barely left Rin's room, but is acting differently. Rin tells him about Neesha's power. Kate warns her that Neesha is fragile and Rin should, quote, stop trying to break him, end quote. The next day, they have a trial for Solin, who does not repent. Vaser orders Rin to kill him. Solin pities Rin and calls her a, quote, puppet to the end, end quote. Vaeka dresses Rin for a victory parade, and Neesha accompanies her. She thanks Neesha for saving her. Neesha wants them to, quote, be able to trust each other, end quote, but Rin lies and says she saw Daji die. Vaser's parade is somber, and Kate remarks on the absence of the southern warlords. Rin sees that Sika and quietly warns them about her and Kate's plans to run away. They plan to leave that night before dawn. My thoughts on chapter 34. Rinna isn't beating that puppet rap anytime soon. I spoke of her relationships as mentor-mentee, but the puppet accusations hold weight. See, she never actually learned much from them. She heeds their beck and call continuously when they say jump. She asks how high. Then, often, she exceeds those expectations. Hell, it took her forever to dig out from under Alton's influence. He pulled her strings long after he died. True, those around her made it difficult for her. But she let them. And that's after the guy died. While still alive, he manipulated her and laid the foundation for that manipulation to continue for so long. But then, she trades that manipulation for Vaser's puppet master. This dynamic plays out much more obviously. He never makes his intention secret. He wants to use her in any way possible, and then discard her when no longer useful. I mean, he treats everyone like that. She falls right into place as a good little soldier. It takes no effort on his part to get her to slit the man's throat. Don't kill the messenger, but they killed the messenger. Granted, all of this is a result of her being a puppet to her anger. This drives her from the very beginning. As a result, the Phoenix, too, bends her to its will. The Phoenix can take that rage and use it to pull the puppet strings to make Rin commit the most horrific acts against her fellow humans. And then the others do the same. Anger leads only to pain and suffering. The pain and suffering permeates everything. We often portray war as noble. Soldiers are heroes. But the true face of war is the senseless slaughtering of children, throwing rocks. The extrajudicial killing of drug? Fishing? I don't know. They call them drug boats, but they've also been called fishing boats in the middle of the ocean. But never fell for the noble war narrative. Soldiers are employees. We're not thanking anyone for doing their job. I respect workers and the work they do. I certainly will not glorify state actors who advance the cause of state violence. It's not a surprise to me that the parade lacked much mirth. Somber is the word to describe the celebration. Even in the barren fields of war, some are devoid of any feeling. You won the war, but at what cost? That of your peoples and your budding country. What rancid flower blooms from that rotten seed? I mean, ask this country, built on the soil of genocide, and with the blood of slavery, to now reap the quote-unquote rewards of what was sown. The 35 summary. That night, Nisha asks Rin to have a drink with him. Linka and Kate. She and Kate get drunk, happy to spend the last day with friends. They discuss what they'd be doing if there never was a war. Linka gets sick, and Kate takes her home, leaving Rin and Nisha alone. He takes her to the harbor to look at phosphorescent fish. Rin hopes he will kiss her. He asks her why she hated him at Synegard. She says she feared he'd exploit his privilege and get expelled when she had nowhere else to go. He asks her if she really thinks they should, quote, raise an army of shamans, end quote. He says yes, and he warns her that the Hesperians want to put a moratorium on shamanic activity, punishing and killing those who defy this rule. Nisha wants Rin to never call her powers again, but she doesn't agree. Nisha moves close to her. Rin thinks they will embrace, but she realizes he has stabbed her. We get a genuine scene of emotion and support between Nisha and Rin. Hey, is this finally the payoff that we've been expecting? Yeah, if only. Nisha approaches. He thinks they won't brace. Instead, he stabs her. Shocking, right? Right? Yes. I know that's the point. The heel turn between the two of them should not be expected. I'd be more shocked if they hugged and lived happily ever after. Yes, there's another book to get through. But independent of all that, what do they offer one another romantically? They're allies. They can even extend that to friendship, but neither one is healthy enough emotionally for a romantic relationship right now. So that brings up a question. What's the reason for the stabbing? Is it a true heel turn, or is there more there? You may already know which way the wind blows for me. Even at their most adversarially, they look out for each other. Rin earlier talks about raising or army of shaman, like the Tzika, only more public. Given the sentiment towards shaman, this no doubt worries Nisha. Also, his experience being a shaman is god-awful. Yes, Rin struggles with the Phoenix at times. It even pushes her to commit horrific acts. But Nisha, his god, parenthetically the dragon, and parenthetical, actively torments him on a regular basis. Nisha, stuck in a corner by Rin's statement and commitment to the way of the shaman, must have felt like he had no other choice. Get her attention with a desperate act and open up a dialogue to try to change her mind, because I can't imagine if for all Baser did, Nisha still thinks of him as a father or a leader. Chapter 36 summary. Rin wakes up in a small room. She is drugged and her memories return slowly. Saikara answers. She has come to watch Rin as Baji and Suni are executed below her window by Basra. Later, Basra visits her. He thinks he's going to kill her, but he wants to send her with Tarkett and Petra to Hesperia. Before Basra and Tarkett leave, Rin asks if he'll do the same to Nisha. She thinks Basra let the dragon take Ningxia and Nisha so he could have a shaman. Basra tries to cover what she said, but Tarkett hears. Later, a sharp pain wakes Rin. Scars appear on her arm, writing the character for wear. Realizes Katei is communicating with her. Uses her fingernails to create scratches. My thoughts on chapter 36. I mean, Rin comes out and says as much when she finds herself in his control. After two of her allies from the Sika are executed, she thinks that she's next. Instead, he wants her taken to Hesperia. Puts the other two and two and realizes she's just another weapon for his arsenal. By extension, she realizes that Basra sacrificed his own children to have a shaman under his control. Baji ultimately was correct. The dragon sacrifices all, even his sons, to advance his agenda. The man, always assumed to be an absolute madman, he doesn't deny the accusation. Instead, he hopes that nobody heard. He tries to cover the answer. Another bit of the crumbling legacy falls out of place. Rin and Katei's, he speaks to her through the mutilation of his own body. They show up as scars on her own arms. She must respond in kind. But where I once talked about their bond as something positive for them both, Huang again pulls the rug. Where I saw the turn by Nisha coming, this one came as a surprise to me. I mean, the bond actually actively harms the both of them. The physical manifestation of this really blows the metaphor out of the water. But man, this might be dark, but I'll try to keep it at bay. Is this a comment on the nature of human relationships and the emotional danger they cost? Well, once true, I hope that things are changing. I certainly have been talking more and talking more about things to try to reverse those patterns. I'll leave it at it's hard work that we just have to get through. Chapter 37 summary. Katei tries to free Rin, but he breaks her hand to get her free as they escape out the window. Ramsa is waiting outside, stationing himself as a shield between the pair and the approaching soldiers. He draws the soldiers' fire and sacrifices himself so that Rin and Katei can escape. Venka joins them as they flee. They rescue Gurubai, but Taka is dead, and Shuruk is in prison. Nisha sees the trio escaping and lets them go. They take Rin to Moag Skimmers. Physician sets Rin's hand, or warns her that she might need an amputation. Rin joins Katei, Venka, and Gurubai's strategy meeting. Hesperia has effectively subsumed Nikon as a colony. Basra is rounding up southern warlords, and the refugee camps are a quote-unquote war zone. Rin and Gurubai want to return to the south and raise a rebellion. Rin imagines all the oppressed populations who will want to fight at all costs. The Phoenix speaks to Rin again, encouraging her to take her place as the quote strongest force in the world, end quote. And now for my thoughts on chapter 37. Ramsa meets his death through a sacrifice to save Rin and Katei. As someone who loved what he did in the field of explosions, chose to go out in one final blast of glory. An appropriate death for the character. I mean, we all want to go out as the hero. He actually got his hero's exit. Sometimes the series disappoints. This isn't one of them. Does this show that Rin can inspire true allegiance? Perhaps, but I'm skeptical. Ramsa strikes me as the perfect lapdog. He followed Atan. When Rin took over, he switched his allegiance quickly and with almost no question. So while Rin may end up being a better leader than Basra and gain the respect, admiration, and loyalty of the people, I had my questions. It wasn't that long ago that she was feeling sorry for herself and that Sika were in near rebellion. As always, she has a ton of growing up still to do before she assumes any leadership role. But we shall see. Part of the reason that I question her is that she again seems to have traded one master for another. From Jiang to Altan to Basra, and now onto the Phoenix. Yes, a constant present in her life since forging the bond. However, Rin now finds herself in a position to be more easily manipulated into allowing the Phoenix to take center stage in their parenthetically, really the Phoenix in parenthetical mission to take down the Republic. The Phoenix furthers that goal to its own end, as gods often do. Yes, I'm a former grumpy atheist. I'm still more or less an atheist, perhaps agnostic, which is just a less committed atheist. In either case, I'm not as grumpy. I can talk religion calmly and rationally, and God worked on his PR lately. Parenthetically, I love woke Pope in parenthetical, but his original vibe is abusive magical space dad. Love me, worship me, sacrifice your son or brother for me, and I will flood the planet because you're not loving me enough. I'm sure the people can tell me, by using and twisting several Bible verses, why I'm wrong, no matter what I say. But I mean, gestures broadly, giving into the idea that everything, even religion, is patriarchal, hasn't exactly worked out for us. Okay, I'm losing the thread. Final word. Rin thinks she's in charge. Narrator. She wasn't in charge. And now for my final word. Three major themes that permeate throughout the book and arose big time here are the geography of power, the cycle of trauma, and that there are no victors in war. I will talk about them in that order. What is the geography of power? I'm glad you asked. In the book, the wealthy and prosperous come from one part of the country, and the lower classes largely come from the other. Prosperous North versus the desolate South. This often comes up in discussions in this country. Too often, it gets written off as an excuse. However, having seen the issue from both sides, parenthetically comfortable, not wealthy, in parenthetical, I could say that it is all state violence. The state consolidates its power at the expense of the people. Wealthy, parenthetically, or scared white people, in parenthetical, flee from the evil poor like poverty is contagious. It is, but the carriers are not the people themselves. It's the exploitation of resources and hoarding of those resources that causes poverty to spread within a particular region. Yes, people can rise above that exploitation, but it takes help from a community. Nobody becomes successful completely by themselves, and that is the reason that they continue to attack the social welfare state. They may believe that they are helping others by, quote unquote, getting them off assistance and becoming more self-reliant, end quote, but that's been proven time and again to be complete bullshit. Most people take the help and use that help to move upward or forward. And for people who believe that everything is zero sum, that's fucking scary. If they have more, we have less. So convince them that they're lazy and keep them under the crushing weight of the system. Plus, since they are desperate, they'll all work for the peanuts that you offer. It's a win-win for you, and everyone else loses. Just as white American Jesus said, this sees naturally into the second part. Just as poverty then becomes a cycle almost impossible to escape, that leads to violence. When you're constantly stressed, you lash out. Religion tells you that abuse is love, parenthetically, certain Christian faiths, and parenthetically, the state tells you that violence is love. And so that gets passed down generation after generation until someone stops the cycle. I've probably told this story before, but if you're just joining us, here goes. If you've heard it, skip ahead a few seconds to get to the next point. My father hit me and my brothers. Hey, I got hit as a kid. I turned out fine. Well, actually, no. I hit my kids when they were younger. So I thought about it. I already had all of the power in this relationship. Why do I feel the need to terrorize this young child anymore to exert more power? It makes no sense, and it just serves to uphold society's shitty norms. My wife asked recently why everybody is so mean. Well, ignoring the fact that Donald Trump shows us regularly that being quote unquote mean is rewarded in this stupid society, they all grew up with that, what I grew up with. Add to that the fact that Facebook's algorithm feeds that anger and rage, extreme emotions of which people only allow to be anger and sadness. Why not give in to unbridled joy? Yes, I often say that anger and sadness are human emotions, but why live there? It's just a weird vibe. So far, my way hasn't worked, but who knows? Maybe it eventually will. Finally, for this book, Baji says, quote, there are no victors in war, end quote. I mean, you can read that as Olympic level cope on her part, but read more generously, she's not wrong. Yes, a winner is declared, and perhaps we convince ourselves that we have won and that we're the good guys. Hey, it might even be true. You fought against the Nazis and liberated the camps? I'd call you a good guy and a winner. However, as the current wars are showing us, too often wars are started as campaigns of aggression, and these ghouls will never be happy. It will traumatize entire generations, parenthetical, cycle of violence, and parenthetical, in order to have more. I mean, all of this, it's all connected. Sociopaths look to undermine and destroy society. We try to keep it together and reward those who work with us. Right now, they are quote unquote winning, but I do see some progress on our side. The absolute naked aggression is turning people off, making them realize the crimes, parenthetically, generally speaking, not legally speaking, in parenthetical, being perpetrated. I do think that we eventually need to meet violence with violence. Someone may win that war, but at what cost? And how long until we ever see the fruits of that victory? Will we ever? Will our children's children? I mean, yes, we plant trees that will never feel the benefits of the shade. So perhaps the winners are generations away. It's an interesting idea, but I don't really have the time to cover it all right now. It's a weird book. I overall like the story. I don't necessarily like many, if any, of the characters. There's a couple, obviously. Like, Kate is good. Nisha, when he's good, he's good. Rin is Rin, you know? What more can I say about her? Yeah, and the rest of them are kind of crappy. But I do enjoy the story, and I enjoy the history that the book leads me to after I read it and go in searching. And when I go in search of where she got the idea for the books and the story, history is interesting. It's horrifying, but it's interesting. That's it for the Dragon Republic. Finally, I will be back on Thursday with the first episode of Legends and Lattes, which will hopefully be a more upbeat book than the last couple of ones that I've read. As always, thanks for listening. You can find us, if you haven't already, at www.twoguysgaming.net. We have articles. I'm going to put the last article of Marvel Zombies up tomorrow. We have this podcast. That's about it. That's all we have on the website. But I do have a TikTok that I'm quite active on. I actually had somebody contact me about making them something using crochet, which is kind of neat. I also have a YouTube that I was very active on in October and just posted something about the Comic Con. I'm going to post another video going a little bit deeper into the comic books that I got at the Comic Con. That's pretty much all we got for socials. I don't really do the meta socials as much for side of things. I use those more for my personal, which is probably a bad thing, but what are you going to do? Yeah, anyway, I'll be back on Thursday with Legends and Lattes. I'll talk to you then. Bye, guys.
We are two guys gaming.